Game on.
Game on.
2FM.
And you're welcome to Game On here on 2FM. It's Hugh Cal with you until 8 o'clock tonight. We have Ronan O'Gara and Bernard Jackman on rugby in a few minutes' time. Tony Barrett from The Times on Brendan Rodgers' struggles at Liverpool. Eddie Hearn on the growing prospect of Frampton against Quigg. And Jeff Shepherd, all things USA, including the NFL. Gary Murphy is with me in studio as well, which means we have golf to come. Any questions for Gary or the lads? 51552 is our text number at Game On 2FM on Twitter. You, sir, are very welcome.
Thank you very much, Hugh.
In fairness to you, you didn't miss a golf question last night at our table quiz, of which we finished second.
Didn't get any other ones, though.
There was only, I was in your boat. The rugby round, I really should hang myself.
Yeah, you let us down tragically.
Badly. We finished second overall. Well done to the lads in balls.ie, who are all using iPads and mobile phones for the whole thing. Only explanation for it, but we're a bit disappointed that we didn't win it.
It must be nerve-wracking doing the rugby commentary, considering your knowledge of the game is so poor.
Absolutely atrocious, yeah. It was shown up in a bad light last night, but it was very enjoyable, I have to say. Raised a few quid, I should say, for the refugees in Syria. So that was the aim of the game. And thanks to all the lads in Copperface Jacks as well. We're going to talk about the Tour Championship later on. Big weekend for Rory McIlroy. People are writing him off already. I was on golf.com earlier on and saying, you know, his era is gone. Like, the McIlroy era is over. Surely that's madness, considering he's been out for half the season.
Yeah, because when he won in Harding Park, he was... You know, he beat up everyone and was top of the tree. And he just got injured and he's just coming back. And golf is not a game that you can and pick up and chase at it again. So he's easing his way back. Did well last week. And I think he'll go very close this weekend.
Okay, we're going to move on to rugby because Ronan O'Gara and Bernard Jackman are on the line. Hey, lads. Thanks for being with us. Just want to start with England, if you don't mind, for a minute, Ronan. And just your own opinion on Stuart Lancaster's decision to drop George Ford for the Wales game. It seems to me like a bit of a harsh one. I know he's quite understandably devastated about it. What do you think about the whole thing?
Yeah, it is a bit of a surprise to me, but the longer I reflected on it, I don't think it was too much of a surprise. It's just two good out halves. George Ford has been probably good, but not excellent, and you probably need to be excellent not to give Farrell a start, you know.
Really?
I'm more surprised it was the Australia game. I don't think drop would be the word in this occasion. It's probably rotation. If he doesn't start against Australia, that means he's dropped, I think, you know, if there's two performances consecutively. So I think we might be overreading the situation. I think you have a good option with Farrell, the way he plays the game, controls the game. Ford has done little wrong. I think he has the touch of magic, the X factor. But I think... it's about managing two players, but have you damaged Ford's confidence? Farrell will be up for it, but what's the plan for the bigger games coming forward, I suppose?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And look, maybe Farrell's getting a bit of a bad time of it. You obviously rate him quite highly, Owen Farrell.
Well, you have to remember that he was the out half on the Lions, and if you remember for the third test, he was probably pushing Johnny hard in terms of getting selected for that, but that was probably a little bit of English bias in that selection criteria. But you forget how young he is, how much he's achieved in the game. I think a few years ago they were talking about him being the next Wilkinson, then Ford has come in and done really well, and all of a sudden Farrell has finished. Now Farrell is the saviour again. It's not consistent in people's, I suppose, criteria how they're looking at these players. So you have two very good players, I feel, and it's a case of just managing them. And if, you know what I mean, obviously, if Farrell wasn't picked to start this game, when is he going to get a game? Because I don't think you start him against Australia, judging on he hasn't played enough rugby in terms of big games. So there are a few different viewpoints. Have you crushed Ford's confidence? Perhaps. How is he meant to feel when he, you know what I mean, he's done very little wrong and he's been hugely exciting and I think he has the potential to be the best in the world. So it's a position of strength for England, I would think, most definitely.
Yeah, it's not a bad option to have. Bernard, what's your view on it? I mean, just reading today, a couple of former internationals, Will Carling and the like, have said that probably the physicality that Wales will bring means that the bigger man, in terms of the control that Farrell brings, is the reason why Lancaster has gone from. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think he's a huge man. I think, obviously, the way he plays with Saracens, he just probably does control the game a little bit in a very different way. He's probably got probably a better kicking game. You know, I think what Forge gives you is excitement, but this game against Wales, obviously Lancaster is probably going to try and not play too much and play towards his forwards and keep the ball in front of his forwards. So, yeah, I would agree with Ron. I think that, you know, the Australia game is key. The group they're in, because of the quality, it's highly likely any of the 10s were going to play the four games. And it's just a case of giving both of them a chance, I suppose, first two, and then making a call based on how they want to attack Australia. So I thought Ford, I think Ford gives them a different variety, and I think England are lacking that little bit of creativity for sure. But obviously he feels to beat Wales, Farrell is the man, and it's going to be interesting to see, you know, if that's both of them are very, very good players, you know, who have the mental toughness to edge ahead and keep their confidence and perform now in high pressure games, because for me the English team look a little bit short of experience and leadership, and it's a lot to ask, you know, a young 10 to do it all on his own. But if you are to pick one who has more experience, and you know, people say that Farrell, you know, incredibly mentally tough, you know, training with Saracens, you know, hanging around the senior team since he's 14, 15, training with them since he's, you know, 16, 17, and he just always had a lot of maturity about him. So, you know, Lancaster's under big pressure. I didn't think England were very impressive against Fiji, and maybe that pressure is making them, I suppose, tighten up a little bit and look to play a little bit more low-risk rugby.
And maybe that experience, Roland, will help Sam Burgess. He starts in the centre for England in a big game against a very experienced player, Jamie Roberts. I was just wondering, you know, in terms of the transition from Union to League, I mean, obviously Kearney came in at Munster and you might have seen a bit of that in terms of what it takes to adapt. Burgess has been doing a lot of homework, we hear, and it'll be interesting to see how he gets on.
Yeah, it will be, but I think what he excels in is looking for action. He always comes up with a few dominant hits, and I think in this day and age, dominant tackles are very important to the team. I think he has plenty of skills. He's well able to carry the ball, but you look at him coming out of the line to stop Sharzetsky in one of the warm-up games. He comes up with big plays, and I think he imposes himself on the game, and he doesn't wait for the game, and it's a good attribute to have. I think some people wait for the things to happen, but he seems to seek action, and I've been impressed with him. I think there's a lot of people claiming for him to get into the back row, but I'd love to, as a 10, play with him, because I think you can do, obviously if you get a one-on-one, he's going to win the game line, but you can use him as a decoy to attract players, to create space for other people. So he's a great option to have, I think, in your team.
Yeah. I mentioned Gordon Darcy's piece last night to Tony Ward, Bernard, just on how much learning it takes to kind of be comfortable at centre, and just in terms of the reads and defending situations and knowing when to go with your man, when to let someone else take it. And obviously, you know, Sam has been doing an awful lot of that, but he can be exposed if he's not on the mark, like Creel was for South Africa against Japan. I mean, there's a bit of pressure on him there to perform.
Yeah, there's for sure, but defence is something he tries on, and he generally, it's probably, I'd say Stuart Lancaster's probably, you know, annoyed that Bath kind of introduced him into rugby in the back row. It would have been great if he had, you know, five or six more games at centre. But having said that, for me, you know, the games that I've looked at England have played, he hasn't been identifiable as a weakness there. I think the problem here, you know, if you start to try and target him, obviously, if you get it wrong, as Rowan said, he would make an impact tackle, and that would turn into massive energy for England. So he, for me, he's a very good defender. It was interesting in the article Gordon read, Gordon wrote, for me, John de Villiers was the fault for that defence. It wasn't Jesse Creel. I know that the 13 is a very difficult place to defend, but he's going to play 12. Barrett is a very good defender, very intelligent. Farrell is a good defender, and from, you know, the way Wales play, it's very direct. So it's going to be, you know, it's going to be very collision focused. It's going to be who can get you try and get over the gain line, the most frequent, and Jamie Roberts against him is going to be fascinating. But I don't see him as a defensive weakness, and I think that, you know, with Barrett and Farrell around him, they'd be pretty solid there. I certainly wouldn't be looking to attack that area of the pitch anyway.
Yeah, and he's a monster. Myself and Donald Lennon.
Also with that too, I think the fact that he spent so much time with the Rabbitohs, and you look at a lot of rugby union, an awful lot of what happens in rugby league is introduced into rugby union attack.
Yeah.
So he'd be well used to the double lines of attack. I think, as Bernard said, I don't think fellas will take him on a one-on-one, but also for trail lines. It's not as if he's just hitting in all the time. I think he's capable of footwork. So
he's a monster as well, Ron.
Very smart defender in the fact that, like, the skills which they play the 13-man game, you look at that, they're always, I think, ahead in terms of how they view the game from union. So it's he'd have that advantage of coming up against the top attack in Australian rugby league.
Who do you fancy? I mean, Wales are down a few, that's well documented, but I mean, they seem to have picked a very good team, and they'll be gunning for England. Do you think England will win it, Donald?
I do.
Okay.
I do. I think England... I thought England were bad against Fiji. I think they'll be disappointed. I think they'll have a look at themselves. I think I expected them to come out better against Fiji. I don't think they did, with the exception of Mike Brown. I think he has his game where no one else has their game, and I think the other 14 will bring it to that level. And I think I just look at the weaknesses, and Bernard would know not more than I would. Number 3 for Wales, Alwyn Jones, if he's carrying a medial ligament, it's hard enough to take England on when you're at full fitness. And I just think their pack will batter them after 70 minutes.
Yeah, Samson Lee's only on the bench, Bernard, which maybe is a bit of a surprise given he's been touted as Adam Jones' long term replacement, but he just hasn't had a lot of rugby, and this is a high intensity game he's gone into.
Yeah, exactly. And England, I fancy England as well. I know Wales were good in the Viva, but I think Ireland were short of I suppose, rugby fitness. And I think you won't out muscle England. I think you can, you know, be more creative than them. Certainly, I think Australia would pose England big problems, but certainly I would expect a big reaction from England. I'm just not sure Wales, given the injuries they've had, in terms of their depth as well, and like losing likes of Halfpenny, I think they're big blows, and I think England will be good enough to get the win there.
Okay, just quickly then on Ireland, Ronan, before I let you go, Romania on Sunday, obviously, I just wanted to ask you about Johnny Sexton. He played so well against Canada, looked to have that old confidence back, you know, just brimming with confidence, controlling the game. Do you play him in every match to try and keep that kind of form going, or would you give him a rest against Romania this weekend?
Yeah, I don't think it's necessary for him to play this weekend. I think Johnny's well seasoned at this stage to know how to get himself up for games. I think if you're looking at a big picture, 7 Saturdays in a row and that kind of form, it's probably asking a little bit too much. So I think, you know, he was excellent for 50-odd minutes. Probably break this weekend, I think, ramp it up, Italy, drive it to a new level against France, and then keep it going for quarter-final, semi-final, final, hopefully, you know.
Okay, listen, you're in Dublin tonight. I know you're heading out there. Myself and Gary are going for a few drinks later on if you want to join us. Gary wants to go up to the George and see what the fuss is about. So if you want to come up and join us, you're more than welcome. Go and enjoy it.
No, I'm going back studying for my French exam. Okay. I can't join you.
All right.
Bernard, you've work to do.
Yeah. Listen, thanks a million.
See you. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye. Bernard, are you still there? Is he gone? All right, he's gone. Okay, don't worry about it. Right, I just wanted to play you while you're here. Don't give me that look. A clip of Warren Gatland about basically... they were warned today, Wales, as to their conduct, because they had guys that were outside their 31-man panel training with the team. And World Rugby said that they basically didn't believe there was a deliberate breach of the rules. They're 150 miles from Wales, where these lads just happened to be walking around the training camp. And, oh, sure, come on in and join us. This is what Gatland had to say when he was asked by a journalist about it earlier on. Have a listen. It's a bit of a cringe one.
We didn't do anything that we thought was out of hand. Bought some players in for training, for a little bit of defence work.
Do you agree with that sentiment, the spirit, that you were in breach of the spirit?
Well, what does that mean? What is the spirit of what the you got? Oh, they got rules. They haven't got rules. So what's the spirit of the rules?
World Rugby is saying that if you're going to do opposed work,
you don't really know what you're talking about, do you?
They're saying you've got to get players who aren't involved in your surrounding squad. Does that make any sense to you as a regulation?
Yeah, but it doesn't say that in the rules. So if you can explain that to me, go and ask World Rugby what rule we've broken. Well, they haven't broken any rules. They've broken the spirit of the rules. What does that mean?
What does that mean? Broken the spirit of the rules.
Well, it means he's an arrogant arsehole, Gatland, really, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you know what? I've been in that position.
And you get flustered and you...
You do. Your mind goes blank. Everyone starts looking at you. Yeah. And all the points that you had laid out in your head just before you asked the question just vanish out the door.
He should have just asked him, can you not count? Because obviously you can't. Yeah. You're allowed, what, 31 guys?
Exactly, yeah.
We'll bring in some guys for extra defensive practice.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just breaking the rules.
Yeah, no, it's
and he doesn't sound like he has much spirit himself anyway, so...
No, he can't. Listen, I mean, I've been in his company a few times. He's a really charming, nice guy when he's in good form, and he's not in good form.
He's very arrogant when his back's to the wall, though. Very arrogant.
He does, and he has that kind of a predatory instinct. He goes on the attack against other things. As Joe Schmidt found out in the recent series, he questioned Ireland's style of play, said they were too narrow, that there was nothing for Wales to worry about out wide. That's Gatland. Look, that's the way he's obviously very successful.
Yeah, he has. You know?
But it's not a nice position for that reporter to be in, I have to say.
It's a bit like kind of going back to the, you know, the Brian O'Driscoll thing. I think we'll never forgive him. So,
yeah.
Regardless of whatever it is after that.
No, I agree. Few questions for you, which I'll get to a little bit later on. 5-1-5-5-2. Any thoughts on the rugby by this weekend, by the way? Ireland against Romania, starting team, who you'd like to see. Tommy Bowe surely deserves a chance. Simon Zeebo.
If I could get someone to tweet in as well, because there was an article in The Independent today that five ways for Namibia to beat the All Blacks.
Yeah.
I'd like to get those.
Was
answers.
One of them poisoning them before the game? Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Bet that. Quick break back after these. And you're very welcome back at 51552 for your texts. I came on 2FM on Twitter. Now, Tony Barrett, Merseyside football writer with The Times, is on the line. Hiya, Tony.
Hi, you okay?
Yeah, listen, thanks for being with us. You were at the Liverpool match last night against Carlisle in the Capital One Cup. What did you think of their performance, Tony?
It was brutal, to be honest. Listen, they took another step to Wembley, but it didn't feel anything like that. It felt like Liverpool had taken about 10 steps backwards. It felt like a club that was going nowhere, a team that had run out of ideas, and a manager who was under massive pressure. Everything about it was wrong. And I think that's why you get into today, and there's so much speculation about Brendan Rodgers' future. Last night was just too bad. There's no way that a club of Liverpool's stature can carry on justifying that kind of performance.
Yeah, what was it? So, I mean, was it a nervousness, do you think? Are the players out of sync? And just even not last night, let's take the season as a whole at the moment, because there's been a lot of criticism from fans and from former players as well about the style of football they're playing, and also the personnel and where they're being used under Brendan Rodgers.
Yeah, the style of football is totally muddled. Liverpool don't seem to have a distinct style of play, which they have had under Rodgers in previous season, but this season it's all a muddle. And there's certain weaknesses that keep appearing. If you look at the goal that Carlisle scored, it was two simple passes that totally bypassed first midfield and then Liverpool's defence, and Liverpool didn't have any answers. And they seem to be playing two different systems in defence at the time they come to attack. Then it's the fact that they have around 50 shots on goal and then they score one. And at all this points at what's going on the training ground, what kind of drills are they doing? What kind of practice they're doing, because whatever it is, they're not getting any better. And I think that's where the bulk of the concern's coming from.
So where does this leave Brendan Rodgers? I mean, he would have gone into the game last night probably in the knowledge that these rumours were circulating about Ancelotti and him being sounded out. And I imagine, you know, that has to have affected him in some way, even if he might say it didn't. Where does it leave him?
Yeah, I've got no doubt it'll affect them. Something that's always forgotten about managers, they all have families, and as soon as people link with their job, that must be particularly unsettling for everyone. But he's gone into the game. Had he not got the result, then the rumours about Ancelotti would have grown tenfold, and it wouldn't have just been Ancelotti. Obviously, today you've got suggestions that Klopp's interested in the job, and it is. Liverpool won last night, and despite winning, the speculation's still grown. So had they lost... I've got to be honest, had Liverpool lost last night, I don't see how he could have lasted the day, because the reaction would have been so negative.
Is he out of his depth, do you think? I mean, I have to say, you know, anecdotally, just watching interviews afterwards, and despite what he says, he seems, his demeanour and his attitude, he seems like a very likeable person. Obviously, that's not going to cut a lot of mustards if his results don't go to plan. But What do you make of him as a person? Do you know him well?
Yeah, he's a decent fella. He's someone who's... I think he's a different person to the one that walked into Anfield a few years ago. I think he's a bit bruised by, particularly the last 12 months in the job, and he's become a little bit more circumspect about what he says, and he's more reticent to speak to the press and all that kind of thing. But that goes with the territory of managing a big club, and if Liverpool were to improve under his managing, then I'm sure he'd be as effusive as he has been in the past once again. But I just think it gets to the stage where people use phrases like out of the depth or whatever. I don't think it's ever that. I think Brendan Rodgers showed for the time, and it wasn't just the year that the challenge of title, it was the time leading up to that, the 6-7 months leading up to that. He managed Liverpool well at that time. For whatever reason, it's got away from him over the last year, and the fear is that he's getting lost in the job. I think there's certainly evidence to support that, but I think out of the depth will be unfair, and it certainly doesn't ring true in terms of the kind of football that Liverpool played under him when they were playing particularly well.
How do the fans feel about it? I saw reports today that they're being urged to dress up as Jurgen Klopp for the weekend game against Aston Villa. That's hardly a ringing endorsement.
No, it's not at all. I think that was a spoof Twitter thing. And listen, there's no doubt that resentment's there for everyone to see and hear. Last night there was three separate bouts of booing at Anfield, which is something I've never known. I've seen the supporters go on Roy Hodgson. I've seen them go on Graeme Souness. They were the two big ones, but it was never to the extent where there was mass outbreaks of booing, consistent outbreaks of booing during the same game. They took it on to a new level, and to be fair, there aren't many people who are still backing Brendan Rodgers to carry on as Liverpool manager, and that's the battle he's now got, trying to win over those fans again. I've got to be honest, I can't see it happening. I think long term it's going to be very difficult for him to do that, but he's got a few games coming up which give him a chance. If Liverpool beat Aston Villa on Saturday, it's a good home win, and then he plays Sion a few days later in the Europa League, and then it's the big one, the Merseyside derby. And if you get these up there, it wouldn't remove the pressure altogether, but it would at least alleviate it.
And you wonder how the owners feel about this. Are they prepared to stand by him on any kind of long term basis, and I mean even till the rest of the season, or would they be prepared to just say, look, if those results that you've just mentioned don't go Liverpool's way, that, you know, they've got to cut their loss here?
Well, that's the plan. The plan is that he does get the season. That was what the owners always wanted to do. When they backed him last summer, it was with the idea that he would stay in the job at least until the end of the season. But circumstances are going against that. And the owners had a similar idea with Roy Hodgson when he took over, when they bought the club first in 2010. And their idea was that Hodgson would see the season out, and then they would appoint a younger manager. But the results got away from Hodgson. The supporters turned on Hodgson. And there did come a point when his job, his position was totally untenable. And that's the story with Rodgers, is that it's moving in that direction.
And these little soundbites we're hearing about Ancelotti, and then even Klopp today saying, you know, he would actually like to manage in the Premier League at some stage, which is, I just think it's always interesting, the timing of these kind of quotes when he's been very quiet.
Well, there was something about Klopp. It was similar comments coming from Klopp's camp around May time, not long after he'd quit Dortmund. It might have been June. And when Brendan Rodgers was coming under pressure at that time, and it was a similar story then. Yeah, he managed in the Premier League, and he could do something about the sabbatical, and there was stuff in the German press to that effect. But I just think the fact that stuff that's coming out from his camp today, it is exactly the same. It tells you that he is interested in the Liverpool job if the position becomes available. And the question is, does that force Liverpool's hand? Do they see a double Bundesliga winner who would be available free in terms of there wouldn't be any compensation to pay because he's a free agent? Does that then force the hand? Does that put pressure on them to do something with Brendan Rodgers to make sure that no one gets Jurgen Klopp ahead of them?
And do you think, Tony, that say if someone like Klopp did come in, that the players are there in the Liverpool squad at the moment to be better than they're performing at the moment?
I think the players are there to be better than they are at the moment. I think confidence is an issue now, and I do think when a manager comes under pressure, players can wilt. And I think we're seeing that, especially with some of Liverpool's younger players, some of Liverpool's newer signings. I think the pressure of playing at Anfield is certainly getting to them. I'm not sure that the players are there for Liverpool to do anything better than stabilise. I look at it and I think the squad's totally unbalanced. I think Liverpool need a left-back, they need a centre midfield, they need a goalkeeper. Mm. And these are all positions that should have been addressed in the summer and weren't. And that's one of the reasons why the club is where it is today. But I certainly think, mate, sometimes it's just about getting a fresh pair of eyes on the job. It's not about one manager being better than the other. It's just about someone coming in with a fresh outlook who the players haven't listened to before, and maybe that can boost them. But at the time being, that doesn't seem to be it doesn't seem to be a change imminent anyway.
Tony, did Did Rodgers have the final say in all those signings during the summer and all the signings last summer?
It's complex. He does have final say. He has said that himself on the record, he has final say. But within that committee system, there is a politics at play. And the politics is, I would say it's akin to horse trading. Rodgers wanted Christian Benteke and he wanted 32.5 million. He wanted that asking price to be met, and Liverpool were reluctant to that. Until they actually made that offer, they said all along they wouldn't do that. But Rodgers agreed to take Firmino before then. I think that's part of it, and that's all part of the horse trading that goes on. I think he gets some of the plays he wants, the committee gets some of the plays they want. I think that's been evident for the couple of years that the committee system's been in place. If you look at some of the players that have been signed, like for Mamadou Sakho, Rodgers has been reluctant to play him. Same with Lazar Markovic, where he's been more willing to play players who he's personally wanted, the likes of James Milner, who's come straight into the side in centre midfield and has been ever present.
Mm. They'll beat Villa this weekend, though, won't they?
They beat Villa. You know, I said they beat Carlisle last night. So they did beat Carlisle in one way or another somehow. I just think you can't take anything for granted. Liverpool are in that kind of state now where you think just about anything can go wrong. There's no confidence in the team. You can see that. There's no confidence in front of goal. They're weak defensively, and there isn't that collective feeling that they can go and get results anyway. And I think that's the problem for Brendan Rodgers now, is that you're going from one game to the next ones, and if the knockout blow is about to be administered, and if Liverpool were to lose at home to Aston Villa, who have a good record against Liverpool under Rodgers, I just wonder how much damage that would do.
Okay, we'll have to wait and see. Tony, it's been great talking to you. Thanks a million.
Cheers, good to speak to you. Take care.
Tony Barrett, Derek, you can read his stuff in the Times. It's amazing, isn't it? It doesn't matter what sport it is, golf, tennis, football, soccer, whatever you want, confidence. If you don't have confidence, you're gone.
Priceless.
Yeah. A couple of texts in just on what we were talking about. Gatland, Julian Lee on Twitter says, is that a world exclusive, Gatland and arrogant arsehole? Thanks for that. Jeez, guys, get off the fence, says Fergus Chuck. Ree Gatland, do you like him or not? Tongue in cheek, game on. Yeah, I have to say, I don't mind him at all. I know what he did at O'Driscoll. I think that was horrendous, but as a person, I don't mind him. He can be very prickly, though.
To say he's a nice fellow, but nobody likes him.
Yeah. The only way that Namibia will beat New Zealand is to play all 31 players at once. They might scream a win then, says Julian Lee. And the Republic of Ireland begin their UEFA Under-17 Championships qualifying campaign with an impressive 1-0 win over tournament host Finland in Tamela on Thursday. That was from JJ, just stuck that through. Thanks for that, lads. 51552 is our text number, at GameOn2FM on Twitter. Let's talk golf, though. As I said, we'll get straight into the big stuff. McIlroy is out on course at the moment, Gary, and he's playing in the Tour Championship. It's a big weekend because a win here puts him right back into the frame in terms of winning it, and I can just see he's level par now after seven.
Yeah.
So he's got a shot back. The leaders are only four under par, JB Holmes and Paul Casey. It's a tough course, obviously.
It is, yeah. At Eastlake, it's a fabulous course. And I guess you could kind of say it's been horses for courses. Jim Furyk is very disappointed not to play this week. He's
sprained his wrist, did he?
Yeah, he's done something with his hand and he's out. And he'd played, and he's kind of never present. He played 9 of the last 10, and 14th was his worst finish. But he's out, so it's kind of left to all the young guns now. There's no more old timers there.
Ernie Els picked up, was it the Payne
Stewart
Award?
Stewart Award,
what is that award for, do you know?
Just it's basically
lifetime achievement.
Yeah, lifetime achievement recognition for his career, and which has been amazing. There's no doubt. He's one of the only 19 players who got to number one in the world rankings, and Ernie is one of them.
He is.
Great guy off the course as well.
Do you know him? Yeah, is he? Because you know what? His golf swing is... I mean, you can have Rory McIlroy swing. I'd take Ernie Els.
I was actually... When he won in Sun City, which was the first time, he was a $2 million person, was the richest person in the world at the time. And I was down, I just got my card back, and I was down in South Africa practice, and I was in fan court doing some practice. And
drinking some wine?
No, I was, well, there was a little bit of both, but I was actually, and I went into the gym on the Tuesday morning just to have a look around and see what a gym looked like. And he was in there Tuesday morning after winning the $2 million. So that gives you an idea. You know, Ernie likes to enjoy himself too, there's no doubt about that.
But yeah.
for a guy, you know, he still at his age puts a phenomenal amount of effort in.
Yeah, and such a beautiful laid-back swing, as I said.
Oh, it's glorious. It's kind of a bit like yours, actually.
It is. Yeah.
Yours in slow motion, maybe.
Rory McIlroy said something a bit funny to me, bad. Gary, and I think it would have pissed off a lot of people, mm-hmm. right? He said, I don't care about the $11 million on offer for the FedEx, I just want the trophy. And I'm thinking, come on, Rory, you don't say that. Yeah, it's just, that's just stupid to say that.
I think the thing with him, he's got copy a lot of the times because he's quite honest, but when you're talking about sport and then you're dragging finance into it as well, that's where I think you can get, and it's probably happened with the Premiership, that's where you're getting a bit of disconnect from Joe Public.
Of course.
And if it doesn't mean that much to him, why not give it away to charity then on Sunday night then?
Yeah, or just don't talk about the money. Obviously don't say it,
but if you're going to put your foot in your mouth, you got to back it up.
And give it to charity.
Yeah, give it to, I mean, we were in Copperface Jacks last night for
raising good
for
funds,
the refugees from Syria who could certainly do with 10 million more than Rory could.
Okay, that's grand. So just wanted to see what you thought about that. Jason Day, new world number one. If he wins this, it's all over. And, you know, he's just, he's going through his stats for the season. Just an incredible run. Five of the last seven tournaments. And just in the form of his life. But, you know, like everything, this isn't going to last. It just can't last.
No, but it's the first time, if you look at the US Open when he had the vertigo, when he won last year and he was injured, and he's been fit now, and something's just happened and it's clicked. And it, as you say, it won't last. That's why Tiger was so phenomenal, because it lasted
so long.
For so long for Tiger. I mean, he came on the scene in 97 and up to 2009. So it was like 13 seasons of
amazing.
Of phenomenal consistency. You know, and you go through all the records of guys winning this once or twice. He's done it six or seven times. But Day at the moment is, and you would have to say, even if Tiger was back in his pomp, he would struggle to beat Jason Day at the moment, or Jordan Spieth a little earlier in the year, or Rory last year. And that's why golf is great now. And I've said it earlier in the year that we're going to need, Tiger was that phenomenal that we are going to need at least, you know, 3 to 4 to 5 guys to try to replace him. And they're certainly doing that. They've had 24 top tens between them, Spieth and they've won 9 events. So it's good luck to them.
Did you hear what happened to Peter Lorre in Germany at the Porsche European Open? He wasn't down to play, obviously.
Yeah, and it was awesome. Got in.
And got in, and literally, he was the 8th reserve at one stage, and got in yesterday. And let's have a listen to, he was speaking to Nick Dye after shooting 200 par today, which is a brilliant score, considering he doesn't even have his golf club. So have a listen.
I was coming here for the players' committee meeting, which I'm on. And, you know, I signed up to do my duty, so I was coming to Germany to do my duty for a night. The tour did ask that I receive an invitation since I was coming here for the players' committee meeting, but unfortunately that didn't happen. So I packed an overnight bag and off I headed to Germany. And I arrived here on a bus after 2 hours and I got a phone call to say I'm first reserve. Now, I left my house that morning as 8th reserve. No, never thinking I'd get into the tournament. So I didn't bring golf clubs, as you don't, because you're only staying for the night. And lo and behold, I'm in the tournament. They phoned me to say I was first reserve, and then they phoned me again to say I'm in. So I had to quickly go to the trucks and try and get a set built up. Rang my wife to see could we FedEx the clubs over. They wouldn't arrive till Friday afternoon, so there was no point in that. I thought flying home would be sort of more detrimental than anything else to myself. So I just sort of settled in, got the exact same set built up, same putter, same driver. So we have the same set of golf clubs, but mine are currently in 103 at home.
Which is another twist on an already remarkable year, isn't it, when you've been playing by the skin of your teeth?
Every week it seems to be, you know what I mean, I'm getting in through my ranking on a Monday or Tuesday, and it's crazy, you know what I mean, you can't make a schedule, you can't do anything, you just got to have clubs, we'll travel. I said it at the start of the year and I'll keep saying it, I'll go wherever I can play until I get over the line.
Or not have clubs and still travel.
Well, you know, as you said, have no clubs, but I'm still here, shot 69 this morning, so I'm delighted.
Well, absolutely, you've got on very nicely with them. Is there much transition when you've got a new set like that, which you haven't hit before?
You know, I spent all day yesterday doing a lot of work with them, dialing in the yardages and stuff like that. There's no great difference, to be honest with you. The manufacturers are so good out here. They can build a set literally to the, you know, to the nth degree of what you have at home. not that I think we would be promoting not turning up with golf clubs in the future, but look, you know, I'm as I said, delighted to be here, and the clubs are working well.
And it probably tells you once again it's so much up to what goes on between the ears.
Oh yes, very much so. And you know, I'm relaxed now, and you know, I'm playing nicely, so whatever will be, will be.
He sounds relaxed, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. I think you have to embrace it. I mean, it's a very tricky situation that he's in. The not knowing, the insecurity of, you can't even prepare. So it's, but you have to be ready. But you can, if you're emotionally ready, you have a chance. And I think he's done really well this year. I know he's gotten a lot of starts and whatnot, but he's taken advantage. And even, you know, I think there was a text in earlier. Do I think he'll keep his card? I think he will, because I'm hoping he's going to get in next week at Dunhill and possibly at Portugal. So he's enough events left and enough money in those events to make a difference.
It's a bit like winning the lottery this week, though. I mean, you're sitting there not expecting anything. Top prize, 333,000 all the way down. Top 20 gets you, what, 25 grand? That's amazing, isn't it?
That's professional golf.
Yeah.
Or else you bang it, you miss the cut on the Friday, you're down 3 grand. You've missed 6 or 7 in a row.
Yeah,
you know, you're down 20 odd grand, and you know, so there's a flip side to it too, but as you say, it's a huge opportunity every week. But sometimes, you know, we used to say it, you could be playing an event for 100 million. If you're playing that poorly, it's
irrelevant. Doesn't matter. Yeah,
but and like, he needs a break, and this would be something that I just hope that he goes out and gets some clothes, because I wouldn't fancy seeing his underpants on either.
No, definitely not. Just in terms, just very quickly before we go, I've got to ask you, Paul Dunne and Jack
stuff.
Hume, they're both on 800 par, tied for 7 today. Yeah. That'll be enough if they can hold
Brilliant.
That position.
Yeah, they're 4 shots inside the mark, 21 on ties.
Brilliant.
So just stay on their feet tomorrow.
Barring a disaster.
It's not so bad that when you're in that position at Tour School and you're inside the mark, tomorrow's just a defensive day. You just go out and just tip it around, and it's funny, it's a pretty good mindset to have. And if they don't, you know, try, I know they're young and they're only starting out, but if they can just knock it around about par, they'll be fine.
Yeah, we mentioned Warren Gatland being a bit prickly with that poor journalist there. I think Nick Dye is one of the best interviewers. I know he's this way of disarming whoever he's in front. He's just an amazing, you know, when people say, oh, you can learn, actually, I don't think you can learn what he has. He just makes you feel very comfortable.
Well, I was watching a thing on Facebook there about this kid from the X Factor, 9-year-old singing, you know, operatic songs. And she just has it. And I think Nick just has it, whatever it is.
Exactly.
He certainly has it.
I don't.
I didn't say that.
You're very welcome back. 51552 for your text messages. We're talking boxing, though, now. And I'm delighted to say we have Eddie Hearn on the line. Hi, Eddie.
Good evening.
Yeah, good to talk to you. Listen, Carl Frampton and Scott Quigg, obviously rumours doing the rounds recently that this could be close to happening. Is that right?
Yeah, we're getting there. I think there's a desire from both camps to try and make it happen now. It's been a long time in the works. I think, you know, the fans end up getting bored. I think we need to give them what they want. And I think, you know, we had some positive meetings this week. Still a long way to go. But a lot of hurdles crossed. And I really fancy, like, this will be next for both guys.
What have been the main stumbling blocks to this one?
Mainly the split of the purse, the location of the fight. You know, there's a lot of egos involved. You know, there's me, there's Scott, there's Carl, there's Barry McGuigan, there's, you know, the Shane McGuigan. So everybody's got their own opinion. And the fighters ultimately have their own perception of their value in the fight. And they don't really like each other. It's not a bitter rivalry, but you know, they've got their ideas on what they deserve and what they don't deserve. So that's the main thing, is sort of getting the deal right, so that you can go to your client and say, look, I think this is the right deal. And you know, originally Carl said that he'd take a 60-40 split to do it at Manchester. Now he says he wants it in a neutral venue. That's fine. If that's the case, we'll try and find that. But you know, I think ultimately it's who gets what in terms of the finance and the numbers. And you know, everybody's going to have to give a little just to make it done. And, you know, it's like any deal, isn't it? You just want to walk away just feeling like you've done okay. And then you're happy to proceed and do the deal. And that's the same in any walk of life. And it's no different negotiating a boxing fight.
And from your point of view, obviously, as promoter, I mean, you've nearly got to be a bit of a psychologist, really, just to kind of get inside the heads of the two guys and find out what it is they want and how far they're prepared to compromise.
Yeah, there's been a lot. I mean, you know, I've made four offers now to the Frampton camp, and you know they haven't made one offer to us. It's because we're the exclusive promoter with Sky and their pay-per-view system. So we hold a lot of aces in that respect. But Carl Frampton is a big name. He's a big draw, arguably a bigger draw than Scott Quigg. But Quigg's coming off a great performance. Frampton's coming off not so great performance. You could argue all day about who deserves what, but unless both sides are willing just to compromise a little bit and do what's right, because neither of these guys are going to see a payday like this. You know, there isn't one out there for both of them. So let's not lose it. You know, let's make the fight happen. Let's give everybody what they want. It's a great fight, two great fighters. It's a 50-50 fight, and both fighters know that. And we're very confident. I know that Carl and Barry are very confident as well. And, you know, it'd just be a tremendous occasion. You know, we know the Irish would travel. You know, Scott's got big support here. And it's the kind of fights we need to make to keep this sport so strong.
Has Belfast been mentioned as a possible venue, or is that just off the card?
No, for sure, but if the timing's right, I mean, you know, the Odyssey is the biggest indoor arena in Belfast now, only holds 9,000. So
yeah.
But this fight can sell well beyond that. If it was in the summer, no problem doing it outdoors in Belfast. You never know, number two might be in the summer. But we're looking like January, February, and you know, that means trying to get a venue big enough in England to hold it. So I think, you know, you're likely to see a January or February fight. You know, the likes of Manchester are probably ruled out, but London is a hot favourite, or anywhere where, you know, his guys can travel and everybody else can have easy access to the fight.
Obviously, negotiations have been attempted before, just haven't worked out. Do you feel that, I mean, the hurdles that have been cleared, have they been the main stumbling blocks, if you like?
No, I think the main stumbling block will always be the split. There needs to be movement from both sides, and we're starting to see that now. All kinds of other little bits and pieces that need to be ticked off are being ticked off as we speak. So I think now, you know, both these guys could have mandatories coming up, and I think they're probably starting to think to themselves, look, maybe now's the time to make this fight. You know, Carl got knocked down twice in his last fight. This is a tough sport, dangerous sport. You can lose in any fight, and if you do, before you take this super giant fight, you lose the opportunity to, one, have a fight to give everybody, you know, to remember, but two, have a fight that will secure the future of your family and probably their next generation, probably the next generation after that. And that's what the sport's all about. You know, it's a tough sport. These guys deserve to be paid as much money as possible, and this is the fight to do it.
Are you still enjoying it, Eddie? I have to say, I mean, what stands out to me watching a lot of fights is that your reaction afterwards, I mean, you just seem to get a real buzz out of the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, my old man always said, if you can get 1% of the adrenaline that fighters get when they walk to the ring, and you'd be a happy man. Sometimes I feel like I'm getting 30 or 40%. But, you know, I love the sport. I have a real passion for it. It's been my life for so many years. And you know, I want to get these fights made. But, you know, we're also a business, and we have to do the best for our clients, and you know, we have to fight their corner as well, but we also have to tell them when the time is right, and I think we're getting to that moment now with Scott, and I think Cyclone Promotions and Barry McGuigan are getting to that stage now with Carl Frampton, when we kind of bash out the deal to such an extent that kind of turn around and say, now's the time, this is the right deal, let's get the fight made, and I really feel like that could be approaching.
I know, just even from going to watch a few of the Irish guys in action at major international tournaments, that when you have a vested interest or even just an emotional attachment to the guys, you nearly get a sickly feeling in your stomach just hoping that everything goes to plan. Is it the same for you? Because obviously you get to know all these guys, and Scott's no different, and you have an investment in them as well as everything else.
Sure. I mean, like, you know, we go back to the fight between Carl Froch and George Groves, and I was very close with Carl Froch. And that fight, I knew what it meant to him in terms of everything he'd worked in his career, really came down to that moment in terms of how he'd be remembered. So, you know, there's been some great nights, you know, winning world titles abroad in America. And, you know, when you hear Michael Buffer saying the new, and, you know, the ring goes mad. I feel like it's a wonderful sport, you know. It's a sport full of wonderful people as well. But we've got so many great young fighters coming through. I mean, look, Carl Frampton is a brilliant fighter, so Scott. But beyond that, the likes of Anthony Joshua, you know, who really could go on and I feel transcend the sport. Luke Campbell, gold medalist, you know. Fury against Klitschko coming up. You know, we need these big fights. And Frampton Quigg is no exception. It's been too long waiting. And I feel like now's the time. We've all got to get together and get this made.
Yeah, well, look, we'd love to see it happen. Obviously, Carl against Scott would be fantastic. We wish you the best of luck with the negotiations. And thanks so much for coming on, Eddie. Appreciate it.
No problems. Take care.
Super. Thanks a million. Eddie Hearn there. Yeah, sounds like it's very close to happening. I'd love to. Carl Frampton against Scott Quigg would be, for me, one of the fights of the last few years.
Why not have it in Dublin?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, we're going to kick on because Jeff Shepherd is on the line to talk NFL and other things. Jeff, you're very welcome, first of all. What was your reaction to the news that our old friend Yogi, we talked about this in the show last night, passed away? A lot of sadness, I gather, in the States about this one.
Yeah, you know, I mean, he's a guy, I mean, I'm by no stretch of the imagination a Yankees fan. I mean, I didn't grow up anywhere near New York. The Yankees were pretty terrible when I was a kid in the 80s. So, you know, I didn't really like the Yankees. But, I mean, everybody knew who Yogi Berra was. And, I mean, everybody loved him just because of all the sayings. And, you know, it feels like deja vu all over again. You know, I mean, that's such a fantastic, you know, slip-up. And, yeah, I mean, he was a guy who had an amazing career. I mean, he won 10 World Series. But
yeah.
I'd venture to say that, you know, 2/3 of the American population didn't know why he was always around the Yankees. I mean, you know, he had played so long ago and was a manager such a long time ago that, you know, unless you grew up watching him, you probably didn't even realize he was connected to the game. I mean, he hadn't played, you know, 40 years, you know. So, but he was a larger-than-life guy. It was definitely a sad day in American sports.
I have to ask you about Tony Romo. I mean, Dallas are one of the teams that were kind of flagged up generally as obviously an NFL side that could go well this year. But, I mean, a broken collarbone, 8 weeks I'm hearing that he's going to be out for. This is a disaster for them.
Well, and then this is also, you know, so this is week two. This is a week after they lose Dez Bryant, their star wide receiver. And they were really shaping up, Hugh, you know, the way their schedule worked out. They beat the Giants in week one when Eli had the brain fart of all time, you know, at the end of the game. And then they go to Philly and really beat up on the Eagles and make them look really bad.
Yeah.
So they start out, you know, they start out the year with two division games. I mean, if you've got Romo and Dez Bryant, it's virtually impossible to miss the playoffs if you win the first two games of the season in your division. I mean, you're ahead of everybody to start the year. I mean, you're playing with house money for a couple of games there. But their two best players aren't on the field for the next month to a month and a half. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see if they can just, you know, tread water, you know, and just try to keep a little bit of a lead in the division. And, you know, those guys come back, you know, beginning of November. You know, you got them there for the Thanksgiving game that's always at home in Dallas. And you got them over the home stretch. Maybe you're in a position to make the playoffs with 9 or 10 weeks.
What fascinates me as well about the NFL quarterbacks, I suppose, is that, you know, these guys, the likes of Tom Brady, Romo, you know, we just hear that they're almost irreplaceable, but yet the backups, I mean, now we have a situation where Dallas has to go and basically put in the understudy to their star man. And I just wonder, you know, what's that like for these guys, you know, knowing that there's massive pressure on them, knowing that they're not the first choice. And equally, I suppose, it's a huge opportunity for them.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is. You know, you see guys who, you know, can kind of move from a backup position into the starting position. But, I mean, you know, you spend, you know, the whole off season, you know, all of training camp, the beginning of the year, preparing to go with Tony Romo as your starting quarterback. And then, boom, he's gone. I mean, psychologically for the team, it's an odd thing that you have to deal with. You know what I mean? Yes, you're professionals. You're supposed to just play no matter what. And they will do that. But, you know, this guy, Tony Romo, has been the guy in Dallas for, what, going on 5-6 years now, and they've had some, you know, a small amount of success. There are people that don't like the Cowboys and don't like Romo. They don't think he's good enough, but, you know, he's won a lot of football games in Dallas. And so, you know, if they go get Matt Castle, they've got, you know, the other backups there in town. It might be quarterback by committee, you know, just to get until Tony Romo's in a place to come back where he can play.
Obviously, a couple of standout results from the weekend. I was glad to see the Steelers bouncing back. They walloped the 49ers 43-18.
Yeah, they really did.
Good performance from them. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, really. I mean, Roethlisberger was fantastic. And, I mean, you know, they put up a respectable performance against New England in really an almost no-win situation in the opening week. I mean, defending Super Bowl champs, and Brady comes back. The Steelers' offense is high-powered. I mean, you know, Antonio Brown and Roethlisberger, D'Angelo Williams has played really well. in Le'Veon Bell's absence, and so they're going to score a lot of points, I think, this year. You know, the Oakland Raiders got to win, a nice bounce back. They're a really young team. The Jets, surprising people at 2-0, you know, after the fight with the linebacker and their starting quarterback.
Yeah.
You know, to go 2-0 with Ryan Fitzpatrick and the, you know, on the other end of that stick, Hugh, is the Colts. I mean, they're 0-2 and have been anemic on offense. I mean, they have done absolutely nothing from an offensive production standpoint. Andrew Luck is struggling. His tight ends have disappeared. The wide receivers aren't doing much of anything. Their game is terrible. I mean, other than that, everything's great, you know? Mm. But, I mean, they've really been disappointing. I mean, you know, they made the AFC Championship game last year, and a lot of people thought they'd return to the playoffs this year, but they have been very bad to start the season.
Okay, well, look, we'll talk to you next week. Obviously, a few fixtures coming up this weekend. Jeff, thanks a million. Enjoy the weekend, and have a toast to our old friend Yogi, yeah?
Will do. Cheers. Thank
Cheers.
You.
Cheers. Thanks a million, Shep, there. Okay, right. My thanks to you. McIlroy's gone to 1 under par after 8. Go on, Rory. Yeah. Give us the check for 11 million. All right. You're in tomorrow?
Yeah, Jason Day, 3 under after 3.
Okay, super stuff. All right, news and Louise on the way.
Game on.
Game on.
2FM.